My name is Yuka Koshino, and I'm with the Japan Chair at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. The Japan Chair seeks to define a strategic agenda for the U.S.-Japan alliance in a bilateral, regional, and global context. So we launched a Strategic Japan Initiative to incorporate the views and scholarship of Japanese experts in the policy debate here in Washington. For the Strategic Japan Program's sixth year, we invited four scholars from Japan to address the Free and Open Indo-Pacific Vision, or FOIP, as it is animating the foreign policy agendas of Japan, the U.S., and other regional countries. Today, we welcome Dr. Naoko Eto, a research fellow at IDE JETRO, or Institute of Developing Economies at Japan External Trade Organization. She discusses the role of values in democracy promotion in FOIP and whether the U.S. is headed toward an ideological Cold War with China. Our moderator, John Hemmings, who is an adjunct fellow in the Japan Chair, begins the conversation.
Naoko Eto, it is very good to be chatting with you about your chapter on universal values in FOIP, the Free and Open Indo-Pacific.
Thank you.
I suppose I'll throw out a question that we were discussing in the panel that took place yesterday, which was to say that values that we're trying to organize between the various Indo-Pacific countries, we understand what those might or might not be. But what are the values that you think China represents that are the kind of one of the drivers of this values conversation?
I think what Chinese government, especially the CPC, Chinese Communist Party, emphasize on is how to survive as a political system as it is now, means one party dictatorship. So based on this purpose, their values in politics is formulated. So in some cases, they use the same term as we use, like democracy or freedom, but the context is different from us. It is a kind of tricky part that when we hear they are saying democracy, they have their own democracy, but we cannot expect the meaning as same as ours. We need to consider deeply how it can be different from us.
One of the points you brought up in the chapter was how the Chinese are also projecting values, and you talk about discourse power.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. Discourse power is one of the political purpose, actually, of starting from Hu Jintao administration around 2005. And the term discourse power is in huayuquan in Chinese. And quan can translate it as in right and power in both ways. In this case, they use this term as a projection power of their political discourse, which means they intend to have influence on public opinion, either domestically or internationally. When they use this term to international society, they sometimes use like diplomatic discourse power or international discourse power. And the reason why they promote this word is under the dissatisfaction, understanding that they are suppressed by Western discourse and not understood fairly. So they wanted to change the whole sentiment of international society to understand or accept some terms with Chinese characteristics or what they intended to do, or so-called China model. So they are trying to make political theory, and many institutions or universities are working on that whole purpose right now.
Yesterday, you also mentioned document number 9 briefly, but we didn't get into it. But I have read it. And of course, it's a memorandum, I think an internal memorandum of the Communist Party of China about Western values and their place in discourse. Could you tell us what document number 9 is from your perspective and whether or not you believe that it still guides policy, Chinese policy?
Document number 9 is a list of some concepts from Western society, and now it is a list of things that they should not discuss or teach in university or in society. The important part of Document 9 is they prohibit talking about universal values and democracy. The reality in China is it was already prohibited for the long time that in the elementary school or in junior high school, there is some context that CPC won't let the teacher teach. Up until the high school, most students are taught following along with this policy, but after they get into the university, it become a little free. So many university teachers, professors could teach the students, undergrad students, something else other than Communist Party wanted to teach. But now it is also prohibited. So in the whole educational system, things are rearranged again, not to teach freely, or there's some particular thing, especially the market theory, have to be taught. After the Document 9, it seems Chinese society has less room to speak freely. And more importantly, with this regulation, several opinion leaders were arrested or become under control of party. And that made the other opinion leaders feels like, oh, I need to follow this regulation. It results in their own self-restriction, self-censorship.
It's fascinating that you've noted the evolution of values for the party in the context of infrastructure and BRI and the wider Indo-Pacific discussion we've been having. How do you think China is promoting its value system?
It is really my own opinion, but I don't think Chinese government intended to promote their values to whole Indo-Pacific area. But the thing is, they do not support the other values like democracy or rule-based system or the technology they introduced to the other countries can support the authoritarianism. So that end up with somehow the influence on the values on the other countries, but it's not regardless to Chinese intention, I think.
Is that perhaps a linking of the digital highway to the social credit system?
Yes, including that.
If those are the value systems, and perhaps China's not deliberately promoting, but they are coming with Chinese infrastructure and development, what do you think the Indo-Pacific countries' response to that should be? You have, of course, India and Japan have mentioned values in their policy statements, but they've also separated themselves from the US approach, which is quite strong to promote the geopolitical difference and emphasizing the kind of ideological chasm. How do you think the Quad members, Australia, Japan, US, and India, but also ASEAN member states, how do you think they will promote their own value system in adversity to these Chinese values?
I think the best way to promote the existing values with us, I mean the liberal democratic orders, is very natural things for us, but not for all the South Asian countries. So we have a gap with these countries when we talk about the values. And what they are more interested in is development. So the best way to support the values in this area is support their development with high quality way, better than China.
More opaque, more transparent in terms of contracts.
And in some cases, cheaper.
Better rates.
Yes.
What about some ASEAN countries mention rules as a kind of point that they like? For example, I've spoken to policy officials from Singapore and Indonesia and Malaysia, and they tend to emphasize that they like supporting the rules-based order, not the liberal rules-based order. Now, what do you think that means? Why is it rules are good but not liberal?
Supposedly, they mention rules as the mutual understanding, but when put liberal or democratic on the top, it means it can exclusive to non-democratic or non-developed countries. They are trying to be inclusive in the whole region, but still need to have mutual rules, mutual understanding. The values matters for developed countries, but for the developing countries, in some cases, they think it's easier to avoid it.
And I wonder also, another issue that comes up is the state involvement in the economy, but also state involvement in terms of the media. Of course, the media across the world is under pressure now to follow either government communications or often at risk because of non-state actors who target them deliberately. Do you think in the Indo-Pacific that the Western model of a free media versus the Chinese model of a state-run media is going to be in conflict with each other? Do you see ASEAN countries or Indo-Pacific countries leaning one way or another?
Yes, I think it can be conflicted because one method can be different from what China introduced. Like CCTV, Chinese national media system, provides good system to some developing countries. And it's really beneficial for the poor area who cannot buy radio system or TV system by themselves. But it means if China want to slow down their service, particularly on some information, like when media from other countries broadcasting something that Chinese government doesn't want to, they can control the service itself. So methods matters first, and contents also can be diverse. But regarding what media reports on China or on some ideologies over developing countries, it already happened. They have different opinions even in our own countries. And I think it is a good thing to have such free media activity. I think diversity among media is not problematic, but if you can control which information should be provided or not, it is what we may need to think about.
In the West, we're still grappling, but we're beginning to grapple, I think, more forcefully with the insertion of embedded articles by Chinese state media into Western newspapers. And I think there's a debate to be had there on whether it offers diversity or whether it subtly suggests self-censorship on the sake of the newspapers. There is arguments on both sides. But it's fascinating that you also mentioned the technology aspect and the building of networks. I don't want to take our conversation too far in another direction, but given that we've been having a big debate, of course, about Huawei and Washington, and it's happening very much in the West, right across Europe and in London, of course, these technologies come with their own values packages. They both convey the values in the certain medias that are brought to them, like, for example, Chinese state media, but also in the sense that you described before, where those abilities to communicate can be interfered with by the Chinese, particularly if they don't suit Chinese preferences. I guess this the most difficult task that we set everyone was to find policy recommendations. And I'm not going to say that actually our group were very good to give you advice, because to be honest, they're very difficult to think about. In the days that you've been here in Washington and thinking about this and chatting with us, have you put any more thought into what types of things that you see other countries possibly doing in the Indo-Pacific in response to this kind of values competition?
One thing I found while I'm staying here is there are more debates about democracy or ideology going on. I suppose one reason for it is domestic reason of United States. Ahead of the presidential election, it is natural to have such conversation with politicians and society. On the other hand, I thought it may be a sign from the United States that they may push harder on democracy promotion in the international society, which again means to Asian countries, some non-democratic countries can be offended maybe by this notion. I think some other countries like Japan or Australia can play a moderator's role.
Interesting, like a values bridge.
Yes. Especially for Japan. Japan is an ally to the United States, but at the same time, it is an Asian country. So I think Japan's important role for both United States and Asian countries is playing moderator, bridging the value discussion with United States, and accept and agree on democracy promotion, but made softer messages to the countries in the Pacific.
Do you think this is almost a rehashing of the Myanmar situation where you had Japan as a moderator between Washington and Myanmar, particularly on values,
yes,
and even Sri Lanka, I suppose,
yes,
you could also say. It's fascinating. I know that some American observers would find that role to be not their favorite role because it's a kind of good cop, bad cop, and the Americans are obliged to play not the bad cop, but certainly the tougher one when it comes to values. But having said that, the U.S. did moderate its values approach according to the situation, off and on during the Cold War. Often, the U.S. worked with very unsavory regimes if it was required by the greater geopolitical situation. So perhaps we're returning to that type of nuanced and complex political environment. I brought up the Cold War not deliberately to tie into a question that we had for you on the paper, but partly because one of the questions we set you was, are we entering a new Cold War? And what was fascinating is that of all the Japanese scholars that we've approached on this project, the values one was where the Cold War question was. And I think that says a lot about how perhaps Westerners see the Cold War, first of all, as a battle of ideas. And secondly, how it perhaps mobilizes U.S. foreign policy elites by giving them good framing. How would you view that Cold War question? Did you view it as surprising?
I think it's maybe natural things to come up with Cold War idea, but it also what we need to take care more is when we talk about Cold War, it may cause a misunderstanding of the whole situation. Concept of Cold War is a little too simple.
What is the concept of the Cold War? You're hearing this debate a lot in the West, and nearly everyone rushes to the answer no and proceeds to say why it's not like the US-Soviet competition. But I suppose I wonder, well, what is a Cold War? Does it mean, you know, some people say it's a multilateral competition rather than a binary competition. Is a Cold War a global struggle, or is it simply a proxy struggle with a high intelligence competition? Well, how do we define Cold War, and is it useful or not useful as a concept?
I think you made a great question because the definition of the Cold War is a key to understand the current situation because we see some elements like Cold War, conflict or competition along with ideological difference. But the difference from the original Cold War is we do not have separated system in the world, like West side and Eastern countries. As the circumstances right now, it is impossible to make a block decoupling, completely decoupling or blocking economic systems.
The internet, supply chain.
In some cases, it may be possible, like the internet system can be blocked, controlled by the government and then separated from the others. But supply chains or some exchanges amongst companies, or we already have the so-called global companies, it is almost impossible to put the colors on every aspect by separate by the ideology or some ideas. When we say Cold War, we may misunderstand this situation. We have an idea that confronting to some enemy, but we do not have pure enemy anymore, I think. Even US-China, among the US-China competition, United States understands much better compared to the understanding toward the USSR. So I think the extent as well as its range, the competition with China is much smaller than what we saw during the Cold War. In that sense, we do not face the Cold War right now, but we may have some partial Cold War in some field like digital competition or security affairs where the sovereignty struggle is going on. In that sense, we may need to create a new Cold War definition.
A new concept or conceptual framework.
Yes, it is easy to label by Cold War, but the reality is more complex. If we want to use this term, we may need to have clear definition what it does mean.
One of the points that I suppose has not also been raised is that of values inside Asia. So of course, we've run to the obvious division between Western values, liberal values, and Asian values, and even between Western values and Chinese values. But actually, if we just take three countries, Japan, India, China, all ancient historical civilizations of Asia, are they divided by their values or do they share values?
Asian countries share some values to some extent, simply because we have same origins of religion or system of governance.
Perhaps a Confucius bureaucracy.
Yes, including that. But after the Cold War II, especially for the Japanese case, Western ideas, Western values were introduced, and it passed already more than 70 years. The new ideas are already embedded in our society. So I think in the case of Japan and probably in India, we also have common values with Western society as a rule-based order or some ethics that we follow.
So rules-based order, if I can just tease that apart a little bit, do you mean the rules are paramount, that everyone must follow them, that kind of legalism?
Traditional idea of Asian countries, rules comes with power. So when the ruler changes, rules or laws could be changed. But for Japanese case, we have regulations and laws already, and it is hard to change because they are made based on some values. And this value is common among the Western countries.
In China, there was a drive by Chinese scholars to push forward
08.
Charter 08.
About the democratic values and universal values, you mean?
Yes.
By Liu Xiaobo.
And maybe perhaps pushing for not just democracy, but also
political reform.
Yes.
This
is the Czech Republic inspiration of Václav Havel. And I wonder to what extent that moment where China moves away from that political reform and embraces the more, I suppose, authoritarian and party-led form is now we're living with the results of that, the repercussions of that. Does that sound right?
Yes. There was a movement that China should complete political reform in 2008. But then Hu Jintao administration cracked down and arrested some opinion leaders like Liu Xiaobo. And after that, the regulation became stronger and the self-censorship prevailed. So I think it was a one turning point for the Chinese policy.
What role has Xi Jinping played in the expression of these values? I think one of the party lines has been that these are Chinese values, but to another extent, we also know that they've come from, as you said, the Patriotic Education Act, post Tiananmen Square. They've come from the party's desire to maintain control. So when we talk about Chinese values, are we talking about party values? And to what extent is Xi the champion of that approach?
When we talk about Chinese values in political field, we mostly talk about the values from the Communist Party. And the characteristics of Xi Jinping administration is concentrating the power to Xi Jinping himself. Some people criticize it as a returning of Mao era or even to the emperor's comeback. And in reality, there are some criticism towards Xi Jinping, especially after he demolished the term limits as a president. So there are some sense that we can share with Chinese opinion leaders that dictatorship is very dangerous. But now what the Communist Party says is they are so diverse society, and without a strong power, it is difficult to maintain the
peace and stability.
Especially stability. The social stability is so crucial for Chinese, not only the Communist Party, but Chinese citizens. And that's legitimate the strong dictatorship with Xi Jinping right now.
Thanks for listening. For more about Japan and our research, visit us at the CSIS website's Japan Chair page.